Folks, welcome to Pod X Medicine, the official podcast of the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. I am your host, Sonny Whitfield, and today I have the wonderful Bridget with me. Bridget, how are you?
I'm good, Sonny. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. You've been studying today?
Just a little bit. We're in O week for med school, so we're just getting to know everything at the moment.
It's a whole new chapter for you, hey? You've got nearly a decade of paramed under your belt, now you're moving up into med.
And then I'm going to have a decade of uni to go. So nearly a decade. But anyway, we'll see how it goes.
Look, if it can be any inspiration for you this week, we've got a really exciting guest coming on the podcast. And it's an interesting guest. And probably these are some of my favorites because we're going to be coming at this from a very non-clinical background. We have a lot of adventurers, a lot of explorers, and a lot of expedition leaders out there who are working in some of the most remote and inhospitable places on the planet. And they are responsible for looking after people and their well-being. So hopefully this is going to be a little bit of inspiration for you, Bridgie, while you are stuck in a textbook and any other.
Absolutely.
Look, let me introduce Patrick Barrow. Now, Patrick, thanks so much for being here today. I would introduce you myself, but I'm going to do a terrible job. I said to Bridget just before you phoned in that when I saw your CV a couple months ago, I nearly fell off my seat just for the sheer volume of expeditions that you have actually been on. But Patrick, welcome. Can you just give us a quick introduction to who you are and what you have done in the past?
Thank you, Sonny and Bridge, for having me on. Super grateful to be invited to come and chat with you guys and to share some of the things that I've been able to do in the past and sit down and have another. So I guess my background is outdoor education and expedition guiding. I started maybe 20 years ago and came into guiding from probably a cultural tourism angle. I started guiding in Europe on bus tours, the ones where you do 5 or 6 countries in a week, and we bounced around doing that for a while. One of my clients actually on one of the buses, he gave me a book which was written by Tim Cope and Chris Flannery, which was called Off the Rails. So I don't know if you've heard of that or heard of Tim Cope, but they rode across Russia in like 1999, I think, on recumbent bicycles. And I didn't know that any of that kind of thing was even possible. So the client on the bus, he gave me the book and I read that book. And after that, I wanted to do something similar. So I went and a couple of years later, I was teaching English in Thailand. And I'd also previously taught English in China before too. And so after teaching English in Thailand, I jumped on a bus up to China and bought a bicycle and rode across Tibet and Western China, about 6 months, about 6,000 kilometers. And then so I did that, ended up in the stands and teaching English in Russia. And then I had my tourism thing and then I did some outdoor stuff, a big cycle like that. And I wanted to combine those. So I ended up guiding in Kyrgyzstan. And using my Russian speaking skills and the tourism and then the adventure stuff. And then I ended up working in Kyrgyzstan. And so I bounced around between Kyrgyzstan and Russia for about 10 years, coming back to Australia to get some quals and going back there. And then so I've been doing guiding in that sense maybe the last 15 years or so. And I bounced between guiding adults on different trips around the world. And then back between outdoor ed with students, mostly Australian students or British students, and that's been in Australia or also in other countries around the world.
It's an amazing introduction, Bridgie, because I need to just take him back a few steps. There's some things that he hasn't even mentioned yet, which I find this interesting. It's very similar to when you're talking to people like Penzi Dinsel as well, but. I think we've read the same book, Tim Cope. I've actually read two of his now. There was another one where he was riding horseback, I think, across, was it Mongolia to Kazakh? You read a book, you jumped on a bus, you bought a bike, and you're sharing this so flippantly. You then set off to Tibet, did you say?
Rode through Tibet on a bike, here on a mountain bike. And I wanted to follow the Karakoram Trail, or the Karakoram Highway, which goes down from Western China through Pakistan. So I kind of started looking at that, but didn't end up getting there, and ended up doing a big horseshoe through, starting in Inner Mongolia, down towards Lhasa, through Everest Base Camp, and then up towards Xinjiang, and then finishing up towards Russia and Kyrgyzstan.
And what was the distance of this ride?
6,400 kilometers.
How long does that take? Like, how long did it take you to do that huge ride?
About 6 months, with a couple of stops. Like, you're not cycling every day. You might spend a few days in the town here or there, or you get sick, or you got to fix the bike, and that might take a week or something. So all up, it took about 6 months.
Well, this was my question.
And actually, not that many flat tires.
I was curious about flat tires. You say not that many. What other issues happened to the bike?
I snapped the rear pin, the axle that goes through the rear wheel. I snapped that one day when I was there was a storm coming across the Tibetan Plateau, and I was on the side of the road, and I thought, quick, I've got to get out of here, better start riding. So in a mad panic, I cranked it too hard, and it snapped in half. So,
where do you find spare parts?
I had to hitch that section, and then, yeah, you don't. You've got to carry. So in hindsight, I should have preempted that I was going to break that and carried a spare one. And now, if I do that kind of trip again, then I do actually carry a spare one.
It's just learning on the job, I guess. Not that it's... Were you with anyone else? Was it a job, or was this a solo expedition you just decided to do?
It was a solo expedition that I decided to do. So it was super steep learning curve. I didn't really... hadn't done anything like that before. And I learned a lot. Yeah, on the job, as you say. So, like, the first section, I set a maybe 700-kilometer section between two large towns in case anything did go wrong and it wasn't totally isolated. So I made a lot of mistakes then. And but, yeah, it was a solo trip. You meet other people along the way, as you do, but for 99% of the time, it was solo.
The bike gets sick. You're snapping things like axles, and you're puncturing tubes. You're talking about spare parts that you wish you could have taken. I'm sure you probably haven't snapped one of those ever since you've been carrying a spare one as well. carried a spare one for 20 years. What about you said you also got sick along the way. What were some of the issues that you experienced with yourself?
There's two highlights there for me being sick. One is I got giardia on towards the end. So you carry this is the same with any expeds now, if you're working or not, you carry water purification and water filtration. I had an old MSR hand pump. So this was 20 years ago, this trip. So there wasn't a lot of the stuff available that there is now, but I had an MSR hand pump, and so I was pumping water from rivers and creeks and puddles and all kinds of stuff. And I thought my stomach was golden until I got to town, and I spent a couple of nights in town in Kashgar, I think. And then I drank from the hotel faucet, and I got sick as a dog. And my stomach turned instantly, and then I still had another leg to go, so I waited it out a little while, but I think I put myself on some antibiotics, but I kept going. And then I lost a lot of weight, probably got down to 62 kilos. But I just had to keep going. Yeah, nothing would stay in. So that was one thing. And then the other one, I carbon monoxided myself. This was early on. And I got one of the multi-fuel stove. I hadn't ever used one before. And for those that don't know, you can put all kinds of different fuel in them. You can put different grades of fuel. And so if you're traveling around and you've got access to fuel from petrol stations and whatnot, you can choose what you need. And you change a little pin inside the head of the stove so that the fuel burns correctly. I didn't do this. And I wasn't quite sure. But so there was the place where I was sleeping was in coal that's under the road, because it was out of the coal that's were quite large, like 7 foot tall. And they were out of view from people driving by, and they're also out of the wind. So I had my stove set up outside the tent. And actually, what I was at 3,500 meters, and because I was so focused on altitude sickness, I thought that I had AMS. So I thought I had acute mountain sickness, or like I was getting dizzy throughout the evening. I was getting dizzy throughout the evening, and all my senses were on high alert.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
I was so fixated on being wary of AMS that I would walk outside the Colbert, walk around, have a look about, kind of freshen up a bit. I even drew a straight line in the sand, and I couldn't walk that. So I figured I had ataxia. And all these are symptoms for HACE, which is high altitude cerebral edema. But that didn't make any sense. I was only at 3,500 meters, and that shouldn't be happening there. Either end of the valley I was in, there was a pass, which was about 4,000 meters. So any altitude sickness, we need to go down straight away. So I couldn't go down. So I just kept going in and out of the tent all night. The stove was set up outside the tent, by the way. I wasn't that naive. But I kept going. Kept going
Sorry,
in and
I
out
love this
of
story.
The
this is great.
Kept going in and out of the cold to try and get fresh air. And then you're meant to not fall asleep. Eventually I fell asleep. And luckily I didn't wake up dead. I woke up alive, and I packed my stuff the next morning and got up, got out of there as quick as I could. And it wasn't until I got to a town and I stopped and recalibrated and, like, with a clear headspace, kind of reviewed what had happened. And I realized that it was the stove. It was nothing to do with AMS whatsoever. So they're probably the two biggest things which I learned from getting sick and stuff on that particular trip.
You know, Bridgie, I love this story. It's sometimes there's case studies that we hear in the medical fields, and, you know, they're similar. It's going to be a snapped femur or a traumatic brain injury, or, you know, but I really enjoy sharing some cases that have stumped me, confused me, or just made me feel that incompetent I should never be working in the medical fields again, because I feel like that's where I can learn the most. And I recently shared a case on one of our clinical audits, Pat, with the Academy, that was so similar to what you're describing. It's like Twilight Zone for me, because you are the only other person I know of that's been in this situation. I was actually guiding at altitude when we gassed ourselves. And
why is this common?
Well, it's not that common, but it does happen.
Not common,
but the irony is, when our crew started to get sick, I had the exact same response as a trained clinician as Pat. Well, we are at altitude. We're not that high, but we are at altitude. There is thin air. People are exerting themselves. And I thought that they were displaying symptoms of AMS. Where I really started to unpack, I guess, where things weren't aligning was that the next day we hadn't descended because it was nighttime. People had recovered. And so I really had to start unpacking this, Pat, because I couldn't understand why were these people showing signs of AMS at nighttime when we're going to bed, but not during the day. And it was when we actually started, I guess, you know, forming a matrix in our minds of potential differential diagnosis, potential causes, we actually realized that it was cooking in the tents that was causing this carbon monoxide buildup and similar symptoms to AMS. And as soon as you got people out of that environment and outside and backline, they were fine. So I actually shared that case study. And I've actually been ridiculed.
Yeah, awesome. Not awesome, but interesting.
It's
at least you know you're not the only one, Pat.
Yeah, exactly. So how were you ridiculed, Sonny?
Oh, look, people love to sit on pedestals sometimes and point fingers and cast down, you know, as an experienced climber, you should have known, as an experienced expeditioner, you should be aware, and, you know, all those things, but it never takes into account the dynamic situation that you're actually in. And I take all of those things on board. Whenever I've made a mistake, whenever I've got lost, whenever I've, you know, lost a skewer on a bike and not had a replacement, had to hitchhike out of there, you live and learn and develop.
Exactly.
But I'm also amused too, because I think there's so many lessons I've learned where I've packed more stuff and I've never used it in 20 years. Oh goodness. The look, 6,400 kilometers on a bike over 6 months. It's a pretty wild introduction to this space. And I also appreciate that Bridgie and I were speaking about this on another podcast recently. So many people have this idea of what they want to get into in terms of exploration or adventure or, you know, expeditionary, but seldom actually have the courage to take themselves out there. You did that with a mammoth trip. But you've been involved in a lot of other things. I was reading up on a couple of things, and I just wanted to, I guess, draw you into a traverse that you did on a mountain bike across, was it Kyrgyzstan or was it across the main mountain range there?
Yeah, that one was Kyrgyzstan. That was 2015, I think. That was with clients, an exploratory single trail expedition we did on a mountain bike. So one of the reasons I love Kyrgyzstan is it's because they graze there, they've got livestock, there's animal trails all over the mountains. So what that means is if you are into sport, it's a single trail. So there's single trail everywhere for running or riding or whatever. So we set up, I know we planned a route and we found some clients who were game enough to give it a try. And so we did that. I think it took 12 days. It was meant to take 11 days maybe, but we got lost one day and so it took an extra day. And we had horse support. So all of our gear goes on horses and then we just take our day packs. And then we had local Kyrgyz guys who would look after the horses. One of the interesting things with horse support and bikes is that the horses can't always get over the passes that the bikes can get over. Like you can pack a bike, you can pack a bike up and over some scree, and then horses, if the scree is too deep or snow is too deep, they're not going to walk in deep snow over scree. They know there's holes in there. So a couple of times we kind of get to the top of the pass. We would have to carry our bikes over a spot and then the horseman would have to go down and come around and meet us on the other side. But that was a super, super fun trip, that one, actually. Really exciting.
I'm just curious. I mean, you know, people will plan a holiday to Fiji, you know, and they want accommodation, food, everything included, or, you know, a bus around Europe, everything's planned. You sold people a trip across a mountain range that no one had mountain biked across. You had no idea if you would succeed. You had no idea what you reached. You even, you know, just acknowledged that you even got geographically embarrassed on one of those days and you had horses that couldn't even cope with some of the routes. They're your support. Where do you find these clients?
I don't know. I guess one of them was a travel journalist. So she wrote some articles, I think, in the mountain bike magazines afterwards. Another guy brought his camera and he was a filmmaker, so he was hoping to make a film. He didn't end up making that. And then the other one was he was just a punter. He just wanted to go on a raw kind of trip, I suppose. But look, if you're doing that kind of trip and you're looking for clients, if you explain from the outset, look, this is exploratory, this other things that might happen. We might get lost. We might not make it. We might break a rib pin or get altitude sickness or giardia. Then some people are excited. Some people are excited by that and they're willing to give it a go. So as long as you manage those expectations from the beginning and explain that kind of stuff, people are open to it or can be. But yeah, it's definitely not everyone's cup of tea.
I guess being just honest about what could happen and what you guys, like, what your expertise is and what it is you're doing is the most important thing. And going in with those managed expectations, then they sort of not prepares them for the experience, but opens them up to what the experience could be for them.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're honesty is the key. If you're pretending to be something else, then they'll see through it. And you need to respect the fact that they are, you know, they're people too that want to come and do a thing. So if you're upfront about that, then you'll get the most out of it for everybody, I think.
Ed, I'm genuinely curious, and you don't have to answer this. How upfront were you while you were lost? Did you tell the clients, or did you just kind of, we're going to go this way?
Oh, no, we knew. Everyone knew. We needed to get down to we needed to get down to a crossing. We're on a high plateau, and we found the wrong track, and we ended up going to a shepherd's hut, and there was a local Kyrgyz family. I went in and spoke to them and said, oh, look, we've got to get down there. I'm like, oh, no, the trail's over this way. So they actually took us down halfway to the top of the trail. So that was really lovely of them. But, yeah, it was totally clear that we were lost.
It's nothing like some good local knowledge to just assist on some of these journeys. And I think sometimes, too, it kind of adds to the cultural experience, too, when you've got to lean on that kind of support or advice to assist you. You know, interestingly, the regions you've worked in, you'll appreciate I remember the first expedition I guided across the Mongolian steppe, across Western Mongolia. It was with clients as well. And, yep. I mean, look, the first time you do anything, it is a little bit of a nerve-wracking experience. But it was 32 days across the steppe on horseback, and it actually went off without a hitch. It was an amazing trip. But we stopped in Beijing on the way home, and I very confidently led them out of the city to go find the Great Wall. And of all places to get lost, I got lost in Beijing and couldn't find the Great Wall of China, which you can allegedly see from space. So
I was going to say, it's pretty big, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks for that.
I haven't seen it myself, however.
We've all got to eat a bit of humble pie sometimes. There's a fair bit of political instability over in Kyrgyzstan, though.
At the moment, it's okay. Like, there has been in the past, there's been a couple of revolutions, and there was one in 2005, there's another one in 2010. They were expecting one in 2015 on a 5-year cycle, but it didn't happen. It's actually not too bad. It's we're late.
Yeah, so we're late for one. The revolution. Yeah.
but no, look, it's actually not too bad at all, really. You feel pretty safe there. Like, to be honest, I might feel safer there than I would out in the city in Sydney at nighttime. There's not a huge amount of random violence. If you want to find trouble, you can find it. There's sometimes challenges with police or with drunks or with border personnel. You can get shaken down, but that's not specific to Kyrgyzstan, I would say. Sonny, I would say that it's pretty safe, to be honest.
It's always interesting to hear from people who've been there. It's a very unique place to work, though. You're taking paid clients into an area no one's ever been before, using a transportation method that, you know, I guess is reasonably untested there. I'm just curious, were you concerned with these clients? Like, did you look at pre-existing medical conditions? Did you talk to them about, you know, the lack of evacuation resources? How did you actually go about planning this with clients?
Stuff, Sonny. So, and I guess that the difference with any groups that you're leading, I was thinking about this today, the difference between leading groups and if you're like working as a paramedic or something, the advantage of leading groups is you do get a medical bill of history, you know, before you sign up. So you normally know all the pre-existing conditions and whatever might get thrown at you, unless someone, of course, doesn't tell you the truth on their form.
Which happens a lot.
But then, you need to, which does happen a lot, you're right. But then obviously you need to explain, you know, if something's going to go sideways, what are the options are, evac procedures and whatnot. And then typically they need a minimum coverage of insurance because in countries like that, it would have been the same in Mongolia as well. There's limited air services. So like in Kyrgyzstan, I think at a point in time, they might have only had 3 helicopters or something. So, you know, if...
And that's in the whole country? Down, we've got to,
in the whole country, yeah, 3 or 6 potentially. And so other countries like that will be similar. And if they don't get guarantee of payment before they take off, they're not taking off because they can't afford, and I suppose it's the same in Australia too, I don't know, but they can't afford to take off and put thousands of dollars into you know, a procedure and then lose all that money.
Yeah, absolutely. With saying with the medical history as well, is there a fitness requirement? Mm-hmm. Like with a lot of these expeditions, it sounds like they're just like mammoth efforts for people. And I just wonder, like, if these people have done, you know, for example, mountain biking before, like, is there something they've got to provide or say?
So, yeah, I guess there's always a process of vetting the clients and their abilities, because, again, like Sunny just mentioned, people don't always put everything on their medical forms. They sometimes embellish their, you know, their training or whatever. A lot of companies will find that they have like a training kind of guideline, or they'll categorize their trips and say, look, you know, to be able to do this trip, you need to be able to run 5 kilometers in an hour or something like this. Or to be able to do this trip, which is the next level up, you need to be able to run 10 kilometers in an hour. So there's that kind of stuff that I guess clients can look at. Also, there's a lot of what happens when you get people on a trip is, as a leader, you often forget that a client has been organizing this for maybe a year or 2 years beforehand. So they might have been training, saving money or whatever, but also talking to the, I guess, the bookings team or whoever's in the office and whoever's planning these trips. So there'll be a lot of conversations and emails backwards and forwards leading up to that, where you can often get a good idea of where someone might be at, like just over the phone. Hey, what's your cycling looking like these days? What did you do last week? What are you doing next week? So there is a lot of vetting usually, and it's in everyone's interest to do that. I think we've turned people away in the past who haven't been up to scratch, but people still definitely do fall through the cracks.
I think some people are sometimes very unaware of their own ability too, because you can say things like you need to be able to walk 8 hours a day with a 10 kilo backpack on. And a lot of people will just flippantly say, yeah, sure I can, because they could when they were 20. Sometimes they've never even done it before. But when you actually are riding a bike, riding a horse, walking up a mountain, paddling down a river for 8 to 10 hours a day, you can tell me I'm wrong. But I just don't think people actually understand what that's like, because we live in these societies where, you know, we will sit most of the day, we'll drive cars most of the day, we will walk to get lunch, but we're certainly not moving for 8 to 10 hours a day. And the biggest thing I think people are very unprepared for is it's across uneven ground. And I know that sounds basic and probably sounds stupid, but people are so used to walking on flat surfaces or concrete paths or...
You know, that's what we do in our day-to-day life, I guess. If you're just walking around your house or walking around the concrete all the time, I feel like if you're going to go on one of these things, you've got to be used to integrating this sort of activity into your day-to-day life. And I know, like, for myself, I used to do endurance horse racing. So you'd go out for 3 or 4 days on a horse, and they're about 300 to 400 kilometer races, even though race is a bit of a funny word. But on those, you'd sort of think to yourself, like, it's a lot longer than you think it is when you get out there. You're like, oh, 3 or 4 days, I can do that. That's just half the week. But when you're on a horse the whole time, getting on and off to pee and the horse just wants to run off, like having a bath in a stream, all that sort of stuff, it's a very different reality, I think. And the moods you go through in like an 8 hour period when you're not stationary, but you're on that horse, right? Or you're on that bike and you are with your own mind. And I think that's something that people might not take into consideration as much.
Now, and the irony too of, you know, you're used to that animal. There are some people that just aren't, you know, they'll be saddle sore after 24 hours or, you know, saddle sore on the bike after 24 hours too. All of those minor discomforts turn into major discomforts, you know, no doubt turn into real problems on these trips. Hey, Pat, conflict resolution, incidents out on the trail. I mean,
I can remember an instance with a guide in, where were we? In northern India. And this was with a student group. And I guess this wasn't total Lord of the Flies, but it, there was, we were coming up over a pass and there was a forest fire just on the other side of the valley. It was an Australian group, and the teacher from the school, the year before, there was a bushfire that ripped through her community. I can't remember. Maybe she lost her house or relatives did or something, but she was genuinely petrified of the fire, and rightly so. And so I said to the local guide, look, we're going to stay here. We're not going to go any further. We're going to wait till that fire's out. And he was like, no, we've got to keep going. We can't camp here. We've got to keep going. So he actually blew up at me in front of the whole group and was very, like, very angry. He was a young guy. And I guess he just wanted to kind of prove himself. But he yelled at me quite significantly in front of all of his team, in front of all of my team as well. And I just had to kind of stand there and cop it and wait till he was done. And I'm like, I'm sorry, we can't go. We're not going. And then we waited overnight. We watched the fire kind of burn. It spread quite a lot, but it did burn out. And then in the morning, he was quite apologetic and we moved on. But it created quite a bit of tension. And I guess that wasn't even from clients, really. That was from the local support crew. So that was challenging, but we got over it, in preceding days.
Conflict can certainly rip a team apart, and conflict resolution it's one of the major roles of an expedition leader, an expedition medic out on these trips, because if we don't resolve the conflict, things can escalate to the point of, really unsafe environment. Let's count them. How many expeditions have you been on over the last 20 years? Give me a ballpark figure.
Let's do bets, Sonny. I'm going to go 50.
30. I wouldn't say 50. Somewhere upwards of 30, I would say.
It just so happens, Bridget, that I have a document that I can see that lists most of what Pat has done. And let me tell you, it exceeds.
I'll get out of it.
It exceeds 70.
Oh, my goodness.
Over 70 expeditions this man has been on, and they literally.
Is that my logbook you've got?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a quick look. So, Bridgie, Pat was, he's actually just been inducted as an associate fellow of the Academy, which I think is also a really important aspect of what the Academy does, because it takes into account people like Pat that are coming from a non-clinical but very professional background, working in some of the most remote and extreme environments on the planet. And it's where, people like Pat are responsible for the health, safety, well-being and medical care of these people. Hey, how big is your medical kit, your first aid kit you carry, Pat? Or has it changed depending on what trip you're doing?
Yeah, it totally depends on what you're doing. And it's interesting also, depending on who you're working with. Some people provide kits, some people don't. Sometimes you've got to bring your own. It depends on, like, that that mountain bike trip in Kyrgyzstan, we had a ginormous kit with every splint known to man. could fix it, I think for a joke, one of us put on every single splint.
See if you can walk.
So anything that I would have needed immediately, I know, for trauma or life-saving or bleeding or anything like that, that was with me. And then anything more significant, that we didn't need immediately was on this.
And that was on the horse that couldn't get up the track.
That was on the horse that couldn't get up the track. But when we, if you make a decision like that, if you make a decision like that, one thing I've learned is that you never let your kit go somewhere where you are not. I've met across another expedition leader again in India, and he had his whole kit on the donkey, and the donkey went to the river. He lost his whole bag and everything. So that wasn't ideal. So, always have your kit with you. I guess back to the medical kit. An instructor I had a few years ago, one of the things that he was trying to get us to do was to reduce our kit as much as possible. So depending on where you're going, obviously, but You try and find as many multi-purpose items as possible. And I guess in some ways, less is more. And that's, I guess, the wilderness approach to it. You can't always do that if you're in a medical facility, and it's probably not even within your scope to get a grubby stick off the floor and splint someone. You know, that's not really how how it might work.
But what works, works. And what you have available is what you have available. So, I find the remote medical response, it's always challenging for some people when you do step outside, because you wouldn't pick up a grubby stick on the ground and use it in the hospital. But you would out on one of these trips, because that splint could actually be the very thing that's going to limit 90% of the pain of that limb moving. Hey, let me digress for a second too. I'm going to throw a name at you, Barry Price. You and I have never met, but we've got a common friend, Barry Price. Barry is one of my favorite people that I've ever worked with in the expeditionary space. I've run into Barry in some of the most unique and strange places on the planet. I remember crossing the Kalahari Desert probably 10 years ago with a team. And when we got to the city and were waiting at a bus stop, of all people, opposite on the other side of the street was Barry Price with another team who were heading the opposite direction. But how do you know Barry Price?
You'd be surprised if I said Kyrgyzstan again.
I wouldn't be when it comes to Barry. He just seems to pop up everywhere.
So when we were working for the same company, and Baz came out to Kyrgyzstan, and at the time I had a guest house and was running a guest house, and Baz came and stayed at the guest house, and I don't think we did any trips. We just hung out in town for a while, and then maybe we did a couple of small walks. But since that was maybe 10 or 12 years ago, and since then Baz and I have been very close. And he's a wonderful guy, and it's always great to chat and bounce ideas off Baz.
Yeah, the places he's been. Hey, listen, Pat, it's certainly a wide and varied career you've had across 20 years, across multiple continents. Is there a favorite place? Is there a favorite expedition that you've had?
My favorite, probably. I would say above and beyond all of the others, that my favorite one has been being able to go to northern Russia and spend time with the indigenous reindeer herders. So I did that maybe four or five or six years in a row. And the last time I was there was during COVID, actually. COVID was announced when we were sitting in the tundra in the Chungs with the Nenets. That was a beautiful trip. The object of the trip was, it was not a normal trip where you have a team which guides you. We were kind of guests and secondary to their primary priority, which was their reindeer. So they migrate their reindeer from the forest tundra up to the high tundra. And the goal of that particular trip was to travel with them across the frozen Gulf of Ob. So there's a Gulf, a giant bay, which freezes in winter, and they needed to get to a summer pasture on the Yamal Peninsula before the ice melted. So depending on the weather, we would travel with them and try and cross that section of ice. It was difficult for the reindeer because it was a 62-kilometer section of ice where there's no feed for the reindeer, so they've got to do it in one go. Wow. Like normally the reindeer will stop and they'll graze and they'll move on. So doing that with clients was amazing and probably one of the hardest trips that I've been involved with. The just managing expectations, and like I said, it's not a normal guided trip where you have guided support. We were there for a bit of pocket money for the Nenets. Like we were secondary to their daily lives. We were kind of flies on the wall, I suppose, helping where we can. But so risk management was super challenging, actually.
It was totally a leading question. I saw that you'd been up there. I actually thought it was in Lapland. Mm. I thought it was northern Norway and Finland. I didn't realize it was northern Russia. But Bridgie literally was with the reindeer herders going across the ice. You said you've done that five or six times.
In a row?
We would just, so the trip was every year. And so I did 1 year I did two trips in a row, but they would only cross the ice once, so that was once a year. So I did it once a year for 5 or 6 years, I think. The last year, I actually took my 7-month-old son and my wife and my parents, and we spent a week with them, which was amazing. So I was lucky to get that one through to the keeper. Yeah, phenomenal. And
what do they do with the reindeers? Like, it's a silly question, but what is it?
No, it's not silly at all.
Agriculture, or is it sort of like they look after them? How does that work? What's the idea between helping them with the migration?
So they're almost like domestic. So they have herds, and they might have a herd of a few hundred up to 3,000 or something like that.
Wow.
They use the animals for literally everything. That's their food. So they'll kill the reindeer and eat them. All of their clothes are made from reindeer hides. Their tents, which are called chums, that's also made from reindeer hides. Even stuff like sewing, they use the sinew out of the body for sewing. Things like little buttons or buckles, they would use reindeer bone.
Yeah.
So it was pretty much everything. So it's kind of like symbiotic relationship almost, where the reindeers look after them, they look after the reindeer.
The reindeers,
It gives them purpose, it gives them identity. Yeah, so it was a really beautiful trip to see that very organic way of existence.
It's kind of like their walking version of our Bunnings.
Yeah, pretty well.
The Bunnings reindeer. It sounds like a really special and spiritual journey. Like, I think that would be like really transformative for people, and it's amazing that you're invited along on that journey. It sounds like such a privilege to be able to take that journey with them.
Yeah, absolutely, Bridge. It was super it was a privilege, and I guess the same like on any expedition, when you strip things back to what's really important, like you don't have all your luxuries and everything like this, it really helps you to, I guess, redefine your values or priorities or what's important. I remember one guest who we had one time, because there's obvious, and in many, many countries, there's different concepts of time, and in the Nenets as well. So one client, she took her watch off for the whole time, and she just totally let go, and being able to not watch the clock and not worry about those kinds of things and just roll with their daily existence was really powerful thing. So, yeah, that was a really wonderful trip to be part of.
The notion of time. I actually read a book recently, and I'm sure you would thoroughly enjoy it, Pat. It was called The Problem of Longitude. And although I like to consider myself quite well-educated and, you know, geographically balanced, I was actually floored while I was reading this book, because it was the problem of the early sailors trying to pinpoint longitude. They could measure latitude quite accurately, but they couldn't measure longitude without time, because there was no timepiece that had been created that could actually function and keep accurate time on a rocking boat. And I was floored by the notion of people just didn't know what time of day it was up until about 200 years ago. There, you know, if you lived in a village in any one of the counties in England or Europe, there was a church that would toll its bells at noon so people could measure time off that. But out on the vessels and out on these explorations, people just had no notion of the time. And it's actually a luxury that I think all of us have just become so used to that we don't realize how much it actually owns us and defines us. And when you can escape into an arena where time is no longer the main consequence of anything, I think it's actually quite uplifting, and it actually brings back, I guess, the very nature of being human within your environment sometimes. But the problem of longitude, it was a phenomenal story about these guys trying to create a timepiece that could keep accurate time to allow them to measure longitude whilst they were out there exploring, which also floors me too, because then a lot of these early explorers were actually just guessing where they were, which I find phenomenal too, because, you know, hey, Sonny, where are we? Oh, Pat, I think we might be south of south.
South of south. It's a good place to be.
South of Wembley yesterday.
Yeah. With GPS and phones, and we're just spoilt.
On time, I reckon that it's probably Western societies who've got it wrong. If you go anywhere in, like, outside of, I guess, the English-speaking world, it'll be like, okay, we're on South American time now. We're on Italian time now. We're on Kyrgyz time now. We're on Mongolian time now. Everywhere has a different concept of time. It's us with the watches who are stuck in it.
I need to take my watch off, I think.
My favourite is island time. Just take me to Fiji.
I thought you meant like island as in Ireland.
No, island time.
Why?
And why do it today if I can do it tomorrow? It's a fantastic mindset. Hey, listen, Pat, thank you so much for giving us some insights into what you've been experiencing and what you've done over the last 20 years. It is an amazing just life that you've led, and I think it's going to inspire some of the listeners out here. I'm going to put you on the spot like I do with so many of our guests and ask you if you've got any piece of random advice for anyone who's listening and how they can just get out there and experience even 10% of what you have.
Sure. I think, Sonny, first of all, I'll just say thanks for what you're doing with the academy there. I think it was, you know, in Australia, I was looking for some kind of opportunities to grow that kind of skill set, and there didn't seem to be a huge amount going on in Australia around that. Like, there's not a, you know, WEMT kind of thing going on or anywhere. So I think it's great what you're doing with the academy, and thanks for setting it up. I appreciate it. In terms of advice on trips, once you're on a trip, I think a piece of advice or something which I learned, which I tell myself all the time, is so far so good. I never say oh, we did it, and then the follow-up to that is that nothing's certain till after it's happened. So you might get to the top of the mountain, but that's no guarantee that you're going to get down. So step by step, when I'm on a trip, and I guess to get into guiding, probably spend as much time as you can doing your own trips. Make your mistakes on your own time. So don't make your mistakes with clients. And then, I guess see what's going on, what kind of qualifications are out there that you can follow up with and get. And sooner or later, someone will give you a go.
Sometimes the best qualifications, experience, and you can get experience by just having a go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Look, thanks so much again. If anyone wants to reach out to Pat and ask a question, you can reach him through the academy. Send us an email. If you're interested in what we do, you can check out the website. This is PodX Medicine. It is the official podcast of the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. Pat, thank you so much for being with us. And Bridgie, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Sonny. Thank you, Bridge.
Thank you. It's so good to see you, Pat.